Washington Week. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. In Washington this week, the seconds were polite, even gallant, as they completed the arrangements for the verbal duels between their principals. For Jimmy Carter, Jody Powell, and for Gerald Ford, William Ruckelshaus.
Both sides came at this with the idea that the chief beneficiary is going to be the American people. And with that as our purpose, most of these details we were able to iron out really very quickly. And this really only took us two meetings. The Nixon-Kennedy debates, I think, took 12 meetings.
Quickly, Ruckelshaus and Powell had agreed to three debates between the presidential candidates and one between the vice presidential candidates. In the meantime, Carter and the president planned to travel far different roads on the way to their first September 23rd face-off. More of that when the Washington Week continues.
Oh, I'm glad that's the last meeting today.
You're sure uptight. What's wrong?
The pressure never lets up around here.
You should read the relaxation response.
The relaxation response? What's that?
It's a number one nationwide bestseller, and it's already helped many people to cope with fatigue, anxiety, and stress.
Can it help me sleep better?
Yes. And it can even help relieve the stress that can lead to high blood pressure and heart attacks.
All that from one book? What's the catch?
No catch. The relaxation response shows you specific meditative techniques that can make your life calmer, healthier, and happier.
No, I'm too busy to spend hours meditating.
The relaxation response only takes 10 or 20 minutes twice a day. Why, you can even use it on the way to work.
But will it work for me?
Why don't you pick up a copy and find out? It could be the most important book you ever buy. The Relaxation Response, now in Avon paperback.
Jimmy Carter's official campaign was to open Labor Day, but his unofficial campaign trail led him to Washington this week, and to what some thought was another misstep along the trail. Some felt he unnecessarily called attention to his problems on the abortion issue when he appeared before the Catholic Bishops' Conference to speak of his personal opposition to abortion. Archbishop Joseph Bernardine made clear the chilly reception.
We are certainly in favor of any personal opposition on the part of anyone to abortion, but personal opposition is not enough because we're dealing here with the human rights of other individuals, and those rights, we believe, must be protected by law.
More successful was an appearance before labor leaders to ask their support and attack administration economic policies.
We've seen a government that tried to fight the evils of inflation with the evil of unemployment, and which has brought on our nation the worst combination of inflation and unemployment at the same time that we've had in the 20th century.
But back in Plains, Carter seemed strangely out of step again when he chose to emphasize the fight against inflation on the day that bad unemployment news rained down on the administration. That news that unemployment rose slightly again in August forced the administration to back away from its prediction of unemployment below 7% by the end of the year. Still a reasonable target, said economist Alan Greenspan, but
the probability is that we will get under 7% by the end of the year is somewhat smaller than it was a month ago. If it doesn't get there by the end of the year, I'm reasonably sure that we'll get there in the early months of 1977.
It perhaps wasn't the best augury for the Ford campaign strategy announced the same day, designed, said a spokesman, to make the point that you should keep the president you have. Robert Pierpoint has more.
The president's campaign strategy is admittedly untraditional, but that's the way he hopes to catch up with Jimmy Carter. First, there is Mr. Ford's challenge to debate. Carter had played around with the idea, but the president seized on it as a part of his strategy to show that he, the incumbent, is in command of the issues through knowledge gained from his years of dealing with them in Washington. Then there's the carefully planned speech every week or so, instead of the normal long days and weeks on the campaign trail. Mr. Ford's first address will be week after next in Ann Arbor, at his old alma mater, the University of Michigan. As in the preparation of his acceptance speech in Kansas City, the president and his aides are spending long hours drafting this kickoff to the campaign. And Mr. Ford will doubtless be just as meticulous in his rehearsals of the speech. Meantime, of course, Carter will have been on the campaign trail for well over a week. But the president and his advisors feel that it's better for Mr. Ford to stay in the White House, tending to the nation's business, as they put it. Such tending will include, of course, meeting with veterans groups, religious leaders, and others who might just possibly provide some political help. If this strategy does not diminish Carter's lead in the polls, President Ford plans a major overhaul of his campaign in early October. Robert Pierpoint, CBS News at the White House.
Mr. Ford began his week with a proposal for doubling national parkland. Critics charged he was a late convert to the idea and just trying to make political hay with a late bid to Congress. Interior Secretary Thomas Kleppe denied it.
I've seen legislation pass the House and the Senate that's taken years to develop, and I've seen some that's passed very fast. So it is not impossible. The time frame makes it look like it's political hypocrisy, but I deny that.
The Congress, in the person of the Senate Special Committee on the Aging, spent this week looking aghast at Medicaid operations. Robert Shackney reports.
The well-advertised and publicized hearings focused on what the Senate staff called rampant fraud and waste in so-called Medicaid mills, the private profit-making health centers that cater to welfare clients and poor people and rely on government funds for payment. It was one of those classic examples of Capitol Hill theater. There was a crowded committee hearing room. There were the outraged, disapproving senators. And there were the carefully orchestrated moments of high drama, like the revelation that Senator Frank Moss had put on old clothes and posed as a Medicaid patient in New York to find out what Medicaid mills were like.
If you're not sick, you won't be told you're not sick. If you are sick, the odds are you won't be helped. In the last analysis, the best description is the one given to us by a mill owner who said, "Medicaid isn't medicine, it's business. Curing patients is good medicine, but bad business."
The hearings included testimony from Senate investigators who also posed as Medicaid patients that they'd been given wrong treatment, unnecessary treatment, and drugs they didn't need. Also that bills were submitted by Medicaid mill practitioners for treatments never rendered. Medicaid mill fraud and waste, a subcommittee report concluded, amounted to over $200 million in New York City, to $1 billion nationwide. But there is some argument over the accuracy of these committee conclusions. A principal objection is that Medicaid mills, honest or otherwise, represent only a fraction of the Medicaid budget, 7% in New York, and that the committee has overstated the amount of Medicaid mill fraud. What seems to be indisputable is that the poor whom Medicaid is designed to help are not getting the treatment that taxpayers are paying for. Robert Shackney, CBS News, Washington.
So quickly can the mighty fall from power in Washington. This week, rather than face House Ethics Committee hearings into the Elizabeth Ray affair, Wayne Hayes sent word from his Ohio farm home that he was resigning immediately from the Congress. Almost the only person to comment was the man who had to accept delivery of the resignation letter, Speaker Carl Albert.
I feel very sorry for Mr. Hayes. He just got himself into a situation where he couldn't go on.
Once, Hayes' power over congressional perquisites had made veteran colleagues shake in their boots. But few were around on Friday to see Hayes appear and pack up the memories of 28 years to haul back to Ohio. There were also calls this week, some reportedly from within the Justice Department, for the resignation of FBI Director Clarence Kelly, after it developed that FBI employees had done some work on Kelly's apartment, without, he said, his knowledge. The president asked for a report, but the word came, Kelly will stay on, at the end of this Washington week, which was produced by Ellen Wadley. I'm Neil Strauser, CBS News.
The World This Week. I'm Jerry Landay, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. In many parts of the globe this week, men were trying to strike a legitimate balance between the political aspirations of the discontented and the continuing struggle for a relative degree of world order. In Tel Aviv, Israel again chose not to deal with Palestinians who refused to recognize the existence of the Jewish homeland. Israeli policy could have resulted in the death of 83 hostages aboard a KLM jetliner. The hijackers threatened to blow up the plane unless 8 convicted comrades were released from Israeli jails. The Israeli government gambled and remained silent. The Arabs eventually liberated their hostages in Cyprus. With his tenure at the State Department possibly coming to a close, Secretary Henry Kissinger launched a monumental exercise in personal diplomacy this week to avert a racial catastrophe in southern Africa. As black-white confrontations develop in South Africa, the territory of Southwest Africa, or Namibia, which it administers, and white-ruled Rhodesia, over which South Africa wields great influence. With South Africa at the crux of the problem, Kissinger began with a three-day conference with Premier John Vorster on neutral territory, Zurich, Switzerland. And the black nations and liberation movements directly involved in southern Africa prepared for a summit strategy session of their own in Tanzania. Days before the Zurich meeting, almost symbolically, racial trouble exploded in the streets of Cape Town. Robin Wright in Johannesburg reviews developments in the racial crisis.
With the possibility of a Carter victory in November, South Africans fear that this weekend summit in Zurich could be their last chance. For it is greatly feared here that the Democratic candidate will lean more in favor of black Africa and abandon Southern African detente. But the week was marred Thursday with a renewed outbreak of racial violence in Cape Town. On both Thursday and Friday, students of mixed race backgrounds, known here as coloreds, marched on the center of Cape Town to protest South Africa's apartheid policies. This was the first time disorders had moved out of the non-white townships and affected a downtown area. Three people were confirmed dead after confrontations with police who tried to restore order. Peace was restored by Saturday, but tensions remain high in South Africa as rumors spread that a national strike is being called by Africans for next Tuesday. Robin Wright for CBS News, Johannesburg.
Bernard Kalb was covering the Kissinger-Vorster talks in Zurich, thousands of miles to the north.
There's a certain surrealism here in Zurich. Two men from two different continents meeting in a hotel that looks as though it were plucked out of some fairyland, talking about how to end spreading racial violence in southern Africa. The talks are now in their second day, both Secretary Kissinger and Prime Minister Vorster of South Africa accenting the positive, at least publicly, both concerned also about what the black African leaders will do at their summit that opens in Tanzania tomorrow. The challenge here is to find a formula that would promote peace. The way Kissinger sees it, that means a transfer of power from the white minorities to the black majorities in both Rhodesia and Namibia. Kissinger is trying to win South Africa's support for such an approach, but South Africa insists that it's not for her to make that decision for others. We'll use persuasion, we'll point out the realities, Vorster says when he's asked about whether he'll apply pressure on Rhodesia, but pressure is out. These talks are taking place against escalating violence in southern Africa, and what Kissinger most urgently wants to prevent is the possibility of Soviet and Cuban involvement in the conflict, another Angola, in other words. All in all, these Kissinger talks are among the most critical in his career as a diplomat. Bernard Kalb, CBS News, Zurich.
The Irish government received the endorsement of a majority of the Dublin Parliament this week to escalate its war against the Irish Republican Army, possibly at the expense of Ireland's burning dream, the ouster of the British in the north. Parliament gave the Irish government emergency powers to deal with terrorism and terrorists of the IRA. Susan Peterson assesses the development.
Ireland's present government, under Prime Minister Liam Cosgrave, has made much of its law and order image. That image became tarnished last July when the British ambassador to Ireland was assassinated and a terrorist bombed his way out of a Dublin courthouse. So the Irish government asked Parliament to pass tougher anti-terrorist laws. Government officials insist the declaration of a state of emergency is only a technical device, a way of circumventing the Republic's constitution. Under a national emergency, any law passed by Parliament cannot be found unconstitutional by Irish courts. The most controversial bill the government wants passed is a provision which allows Irish police the power to hold terrorist suspects up to 7 days without charge. Fianna Fáil, the opposition party, claims this law could lead to a police state, but the government's majority in Parliament is secure. Other provisions extending prison sentences for certain crimes, giving the Irish Army special powers, and making it an offense to join or encourage an illegal organization like the IRA, are also expected to become law in Ireland within 2 weeks. Susan Peterson, CBS News, London.
This week, the two preconditions were met for the revival of presidential debates. The Federal Election Commission ruled that the League of Women Voters could legally help underwrite the expense of the debates, and negotiators for President Ford and Jimmy Carter agreed on the ground rules for a set of three 90-minute debates, the first on September 23rd. On the White House lawn, with sirens and traffic noise from busy Pennsylvania Avenue in the background, President Ford indicated he thinks the debates will have decisive consequences this year.
It seems to me that with the three debates between myself and my opponent and between the two vice presidential candidates, the American people will see firsthand, hear firsthand the views of the four of us. And this is the way I believe this campaign can best be decided.
Senators Mondale and Dole will meet in one 90-minute debate. Though the campaign is formally to start tomorrow, Labor Day, the two rival tickets have been lambasting each other for several weeks. From his presidential perch, Gerald Ford was critical of Jimmy Carter's call for foreign troop withdrawals to save defense dollars.
There are those in this political year who want to withdraw our troops from positions overseas. The voices of retreat who talk about a phased withdrawal, they talk as if our defenses won't be weakened if we only dismantle them one brick at a time. They are very, very wrong.
Though Carter denied it, political observers were noting what they called a decisive shift of policy in both substance and emphasis in a Carter effort to dilute the image of big spender Republicans have tried to stick on him.
There will be no new programs implemented under my administration, unless we can be sure that the cost of those programs is compatible with my goal of having a balanced budget before the end of that term. It's going to require a weeding out and an elimination of costly programs that have long past served their purpose. And if it requires a delay, for instance, in implementing a welfare reform or health care in order to accomplish the goal that I've set of a balanced budget, then those delays will be there.
Carter also told a group of Catholic bishops that as president, he would not interfere with any crusade for an anti-abortion amendment. The bishops were demanding a more affirmative stand and went away basically dissatisfied. This week, more news out of this world.
There it is. There it is. We have touched down.
Okay, the date of the
Viking 2 had arrived safely on Mars this week to extend the scientific horizons pioneered by the instrumented space voyager Viking 1. There had been anxious moments in the Pasadena Control Center caused by communications problems and a rough landing. But near schedule, Viking 2 began snapping near-perfect photos of the rugged, red-tinted terrain of northern Mars. That's The World This Week, produced by Harry Poloshin. I'm Jerry Landay, CBS News.